Call the Committee on Energy, Finance, and Policy to order. So we do have a quorum present, so let's get the first order of business out of the way. Representative Gardner moves the approval of the minutes from whenever that was.
Yeah, that was me.
Any additions or corrections? Not those in favor of approval, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, we have a good deal of testimony remaining on House File 4, Representative Peterson's bill. Should point out that the first testifier on the agenda, Mr. Cook Coyle, has had to cancel today. I don't know if it's weather related or not. It may well be. So we'll just move into the second testifier on the agenda in just a moment. I think everyone is aware that we will just be taking testimony today. Hopefully we can get through that and get to amendments on Wednesday. But I do want to give everyone that wants to testify on this bill the opportunity to do that. So I hope we can move briskly through the agenda today. And we will start with Mr. Lynn Hinkle from the United Auto Workers. Mr. Hinkle, welcome to the committee. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. Members, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm representing UAW Local 879 in Labor and Sustainability. I'm here to testify on behalf of both jobs, good, family-sustaining jobs, and the reduction of CO2. One can't happen without the other. Honestly, there is no path to economic development as we see it. It isn't on the path to reduction of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Renewable Energy Standard reduction 25% by 2020. In my view, my membership's view, it's critical, it's a key to not only Minnesota economic development, not just an economic development program, but a critical aspect for building a base for major manufacturing in the U.S., comparable to the kind of manufacturing center, the kind of core manufacturing that goes on in Detroit for auto or Silicon Valley for computers. Why would I say something like that? Is that an exaggeration? I really don't think so. If you look at what's going on in Germany right now, and I'm going to look at Germany, I'm going to look at some studies that have been done in this country, and then throw in some anecdotal information from a recent conference on labor and sustainability. Turning to Germany, and I like this best because I think it actually refers to the development of the wind turbine industry, if you will, in a very real sense, not just using economic modeling, although I don't think that's necessarily weak. I just think it's more informative to look at how wind turbine manufacturing has actually developed and gotten legs in Germany. As most of you know, Germany is geographically about the size of Minnesota, so it's a decent comparison. Minnesota, as it turns out, has approximately 10 times the potential for generating wind energy that Germany does. Unfortunately, if you want to call it that, probably not in terms of the earth, but in terms of comparing to Minnesota, Germany has already created 16,000 megawatts of wind energy. What that translates in manufacturing jobs is 40,000 jobs that are directly involved with the manufacture and installation of wind turbines. Now, taking those numbers, that ratio, and applying them to the standard that's being discussed here today, approximately 5,700 megawatts of installed wind energy, that comes out to about 12,000 core manufacturing jobs for the state of Minnesota. Let's look at the jobs growth study that was undertaken by the Center for Economic Law and Policy. What they do is run a bunch of models, and like I said, I think the models are useful, but they don't take into account what's really on the ground, like the example of Germany. What they project is anywhere from 5 to 10 jobs per megawatt of installed wind energy. What that comes to is quite a bit more manufacturing jobs than we see being developed or already on the ground in Germany. Somewhere in between, I suspect, is where the truth actually lies. So I would project that we're talking about in the neighborhood of 12 to 15,000 manufacturing jobs directly attributable to the manufacture of wind turbines and their installation. Now, here's where it gets critical, I think, and that is we don't really have a lot of accurate information about what happens to a state or a region when you develop the core capability of manufacturing wind turbines. And by that I mean, if you look at Detroit, and I'm real familiar with Detroit as a labor, as a union guy that's been, you know, spent many, many days, it's actually my second home, if you will, in Detroit. There's no place that you can move in that city where you don't get the overwhelming sense of what it's like to have a huge support apparatus of jobs and manufacturing capability to support those auto workers who are doing the assembly at the end of the process. It's not an exaggeration to say for every one job that you see for auto workers producing assembling jobs at the end of the process, there are 10 more that are behind them that are building the engines, producing the transmissions, doing the stamping, doing the castings, the engineering, the machining, the parts, huge development of parts. The people that develop the robots that do the welding in the body shops, the people that do the tooling that supports those shops that are developing the robotics. It's not an exaggeration to say that for every one production job in an assembly plant, there are ten more that are standing behind those. So getting back to the numbers that I just cited, we assume that there are 15,000 jobs potentially developed as a result of the standard that we're discussing today being implemented, and you take that times 10, we're talking about 150,000 manufacturing jobs in the state of Minnesota. We're talking about developing a core manufacturing capability, not just economic development in the state of Minnesota. I think it's significant to come back to that. We're talking about developing a core manufacturing capability, not just another set of jobs. And I'll just make the comparison. It would be one thing, for example, if we were able to keep the Ford plant that I've worked in for 30 years open, or if we were able to even get Daimler Chrysler or Toyota or another vendor to come in and keep that facility open. That's 2,000 jobs, and that's a good thing. But that's where it stops. If you do the same thing in Detroit, as I said, you've got that whole exponential support system behind them. And that's what we're talking about being able to do in the state of Minnesota, is to create that exponential, that huge support apparatus of jobs in the manufacturing sector that would support manufacturing wind turbines in this state. One other thing I'd like to say about the production of wind turbines before I get into talking about some of the connections that I saw come out of the last labor and sustainability meeting at our union hall a couple of weekends ago. One of the things that isn't cited very often is that the mass production of wind turbines would significantly reduce the cost from the current 6 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour down to as little as 2 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, we don't have a lot of experience with this in this country, and this gets back to talking about developing a core manufacturing capability here, because right now there is no factory, there is no facility in this country that has a consolidated mass production process for all of the different components of a wind turbine. Now, we've got blade manufacturing facilities. Suzlon is an example of that out in Pipestone. We've got tower manufacturing capabilities in this country. There are a couple, Gamesa in Pennsylvania, that does both towers and blades, but there's no facility, and we're ready to be it over at Twin Cities Assembly Plant that has a consolidated mass production of all of the aspects, including the generators. All of those at this point are being done overseas. We think that with this standard in place, we can effectively entreat a manufacturer to not only build blades and towers, but the generators, and lay the foundation for what I was just talking about, an infrastructure, a core manufacturing capability in the state of Minnesota. What I saw that confirms this a couple of weekends ago, we had a workshop on wind industry. This is a workshop that's attended primarily by trade unionists from around the state. And after the workshop, there were a number of us that were conferring, and there were folks who have been deeply involved with the seabed process, deeply involved with community-based energy development in this state. We had folks who were working with windustry. We had a number of trade unionists, the folks that actually put those big sticks up from the machinist hall over at on Olive, just north of Regents. We had the president of the UTU local talking about how excited he was at the prospect of being able to haul blades and towers and generators out of our plant to spots in southwest Minnesota, into the Dakotas, into Iowa, because we're talking about something that's not just Minnesota either. We developed that capability here. We become a regional center for that type of manufacturing. And that's critical to remember. We also connected with those folks that are working out of Steelworkers 1938 on the range, and they drove all the way down to our union hall to shake our hands and to confirm that, yes, they're ready to mine the iron, they're ready to see a smelter go in on the range. They're excited at the prospect of a real recovery based on a standard that's enacted and the development of an industry that demands as much steel as is currently being demanded in Germany to support the wind turbine industry there. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. We're not going to have this opportunity again. I'm not just talking about the renewable energy standard. I'm talking about creating a core manufacturing capability in this state. It's a key to creating that manufacturing center while remaining on the path to returning our Earth's natural climate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henkel. questions from members? Well, Mr. Hinkle, we do appreciate your vision, and I think we do have a couple of questions. Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, just so I'm clear, your position as a utility workers union is that you support a mandate on your companies to produce 25% of their energy from renewable sources?
Correct.
Okay.
And I work with United Auto Workers.
Oh, United Auto, not with utilities?
No.
Okay.
That's a distinction that ought to be noted, Representative Westerman.
It's a fairly significant difference, but I think that we've made considerable contact and built a lot of unity with members of those unions as well.
So, Mr. Chair, would we hear the same thing from them if they were in front of us testifying, or would they be saying we should also put 25% of our vehicles made from renewable sources of energy? You hear what I'm saying.
It would be less likely that they would be as excited about the renewable energy standard. But I think there's considerable movement in that direction, because I think that my brothers and sisters and other unions, for example, the IBEW, are very excited at the prospect of wind turbines, not just their manufacture, but their installation and their ongoing maintenance, which they obviously would love to be a part of. I think that from my experience at any rate, one of the reasons that we've been doing a lot of work in the labor movement is to make sure that we're at the table. Quite honestly, as a result of our failure to be at the table, what I regard as just transition programs would be more likely to develop, and I think that's something that we need to look at in the future, is if there are displacements as a result of programs such as this, and I'm not suggesting there will be, that we have in place programs to make sure that those folks are either trained or there's some other form of economic recovery in place.
So one last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not all these jobs are going to be union jobs. In fact, several of them might be just private entrepreneurs, private owners. Is there a push from your organizations to maybe require these projects to be unionized from top to bottom, or what's your interest level?
Thank you for the question. I think it's sometimes problematic to require that jobs have a certain affiliation with the union. I think it's our responsibility as unions to show just how powerful and how effective unions are at representing the interests of working people. And I think, given the opportunity to fairly represent our case on any job site, that prospect of workers joining, affiliating with the union is quite high. But to say that that's a requirement, I think it's our job to go out and talk with these folks and win them over. And I think given the opportunity, especially in a manufacturing situation like this, and especially when we've spoken on behalf of creating those type of jobs, it becomes quite apparent to people that their interests are very well represented by organizations such as ours.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may, Representative Westrum, then maybe you could consider co-sponsoring an amendment to this bill that would require union employment.
Representative Peterson, no.
Okay. Representative
Chair, is this the Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be new to the author, Representative Peterson, or to the witness, but there, and just an overall theme I've heard in the last couple of days of testimony is this fantastically large market there's going to be for turbines. Can we talk about that for a few moments? If this market is going to be, let's assume just for the sake of the argument, 25% mandate goes on, how many turbines are we talking about just to fill that at first blush? And then I've got a follow-on question about that also.
Representative Peterson?
Yeah, I guess if you transfer the percentage to megawatts, and if it's, you assume it's only wind, not the other technologies mm-hmm. in the definition, I believe a quick and dirty division gets you about 3,000 of the 2-megawatt towers. So you're talking, that's the quick number.
Mr. Chair,
the wrong number, though.
Representative Beard.
Well, I'm just looking for some ballparks. Actually, what I'm doing here is just helping us as members think about the efficacy of the argument here. And we got several different agendas that are being played out, and now being a jobs creation bill is sort of one of them that is an undercurrent here that I'd like us just to think through, because there's other jobs that are in play here also. But 3,000 machines built at a factory in Minnesota, give or take. I mean, it could be four, it could be two. Any idea about what the replacement rate is on those? How often do they have to be taken down? How long can they run before we've got to pull them out of service or just replace them? Or do they overhaul in place? Any idea?
Representative Peterson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Representative Beard. I believe that every turbine put up on the Buffalo Ridge since, I believe, 95 or so after the Prairie Island, has obviously been maintained and parts have been replaced. I've seen, I think, different blades have put on some turbines piecemeal, but I believe it's correct to say, and maybe there's others in the audience who actually know, who work on the turbines, that every one of them, I think, is still functioning, I believe. So that's 94 to 2007. That's that number of years. I think the tower itself is just like a water tower in a town. You know, it's up, and it don't blow over. But, you know, the technology around the generator and the gearbox, or direct drive, or does it have a cooling system? Is there a hydraulic, you know, is there a radiator up there? You know, is the door got to be hanging open on the back side of this turbine? I've seen that as a function of how to cool it. Somebody forgot to put it in there because we have a hot summer. You know, that type of thing. But I know there's people who've got those actual numbers and facts that I think are in the audience today, and they can either find you or you could find them.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
good. In conclusion, for the moment, I want this team here around this table to carry that thought that 3,000 machines, 4, 2, whatever. Someone has to think that through on whether that's worth assembling capital for and putting up a factory. May or may not be an ongoing business enterprise. Blades, on the other hand, and of course, Representative Peterson, you know I know a little bit about this mm-hmm. topic, are not exactly a consumable item, but lightning strikes them with alarming regularity, and they've either got to be repaired or replaced. And we have somebody who put their money up to put a blade plant, I believe, down around Pipestone, because it's an ongoing item that's going to be moving with some consistency. And I think there's a pole factory up in North Dakota.
Yep.
But once a pole is up, it's up. Basically, once the generator's up, it's got to be maintained, but it's up. Blades are consumable, but I'm just calling into question some of the fantastic expectations we seem to be creating here, that this is going to be 100,000+ jobs for rural Minnesota, especially of a manufacturing nature. That might be overstating it just a bit. Not to say this isn't a good idea or has some merit, but just woe down just a little bit, I guess. That's what I'm saying. Thank you.
Mr. Hankel.
Well, you know, I intentionally tried to avoid hyperbole. That's why I was using the figures that we have available coming out of Germany. I think when you look at the methodology of the Jobs Schultz study, I'm not suggesting that it was wrong, but they're using a lot of modeling that doesn't correspond in many cases to the exact implementation of or the exact process of manufacture, installation, maintenance that you're speaking to. So I agree with you. I think it's important for us to avoid hyping this and to do what we can to come up with figures that accurately reflect the future of this manufacturing capability. And I just have to tell you, from an emotional standpoint, I'm very committed to that. I don't ever want to go through the process of watching a whole shift of my folks lose their jobs because of short-sighted corporate planning. If I'm going to go out there and promote something, I want it to be a part of a very long-term process of economic development. So I absolutely concur for a lot of different reasons that we carefully analyze this and we understand what its real potential is. We intend, hopefully, to be one of those facilities that produces wind turbines, all different aspects of it. We think we're uniquely qualified to do that, so we're very excited at the prospect. But we say it all the time. Our facility is just the beginning. It's not, in our view, exciting simply because Twin Cities Assembly Plant would be a potential first place for this type of facility, but merely the beginning and the launching of considerable other opportunities.
Thank you, members. We do have a long agenda today that we have to move on to. I suggest if you have any further questions for Mr. Hinkle, you can probably catch him after the meeting. Next on the agenda, we have Dwayne Neneman. Mr. Neneman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to speak in support of House File 4.
Could you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Dwayne Neneman, and I'm here from Hortonville in Big Stone County in far western Minnesota.
Thank you.
I'm here to speak in support of House File 4, the bill creating the renewable energy standard. My interest here in being here today has two parts. First, I'm an independent consultant working primarily on environmental and energy issues. No one's paying me to be here today, however. My main client is the CURE organization in Montevideo. CURE stands for Clean Up the River Environment. It's a grassroots organization that addresses concerns of the Upper Minnesota River watershed. But the other reason I'm here is that I'm a Minnesotan with very deep country roots. My family has been in the state for 150 years. And the eighth generation in my family to live in Big Stone and Lac La Parle County was born just a couple years ago in Hortonville. My farm is a long way from St. Paul, but supporting this bill is very important. It'll provide the next part of our roadmap to Minnesota's energy future. Here are my views from the prairie and how it relates to the bill. Renewable energy has become a part of the new rural culture. Awareness and attitudes about renewable energy have shifted, with the engaged public in western Minnesota embracing its development and use. Renewable energy examples are all over the landscape and are a frequent topic in the coffee shop discussions. Farmer success with ethanol plants and Chippewa Valley Ethanol's move to biomass gasification to offset $20 million worth of natural gas is a hot topic. Benson also has the Fibromin biomass to electricity plant that now looms over the prairie. And most people in the know are extremely proud of the work being done at the University of Minnesota Morris in many areas of renewable energy research and application. People in western Minnesota have also come to know a lot more about renewable energy and its potential from the battle on the ground over the Big Stone 2 coal generation plant. Big Stone 2 is a 630-megawatt coal plant proposed to be built right across the border in South Dakota, but destined to serve 2 million Minnesota ratepayers. This issue has locally focused attention on the competing vision for Minnesota's energy future. That battle largely boils down to an out-of-state remote generator burning imported coal from Wyoming, or having Minnesota ratepayers invest in clean renewable energy in Minnesota. Local opposition to the plant sees the benefit of smaller, geographically dispersed, and sometimes community-owned renewable energy facilities that solve environmental problems. And renewable distributed generation is a strategy that may well add to Minnesota's energy security as well. Finally, the level of discourse at which rural folks are talking about renewable energy in all of its forms has grown tremendously. People are talking about its local economic opportunity. Farmers and investors want wind farms. Towns like Wilmer, New Ulm, Granite Falls, and Milan want their own renewable energy production facilities, including wind and biomass. And the Milan mayor and council actually signed onto the climate initiative to reduce greenhouse gases and curb global warming. I'm working on a project with Minnesota farmers that we call Productive Conservation to Energy. We hope to create community-owned facilities that use farmer-grown biomass to produce liquid fuels through gasification with the potential co-benefits of industrial steam and electricity. Partners in this effort include the Minnesota Agroforestry Co-op, the Minnesota Valley Alfalfa Producers, and the Chippewa River Watershed Project. There's just a lot of exciting stuff happening in Minnesota, western Minnesota, surrounding renewable energy. Public awareness is very high, and providing the people of Minnesota with a roadmap to a brighter energy future is imperative. I realize that a renewable energy standard for electricity is just part of a much bigger energy plan for Minnesota, but it's a very big step. The bill is well-crafted and sets long-term standards for electricity generation that are rigorous and yet fully achievable. It allows utilities, industry, and entrepreneurs to plan based on the most likely future scenario, thanks to benchmarks and penalties in the bill for non-compliance by utilities. It further encourages technological innovation, research, and creative business models to meet the market need that the RES creates. The renewable energy community in Minnesota has become a very large tent. It is filled with progressive utilities, community leaders, churches, students, farmers, conservationists, and entrepreneurs. By passing this bill, Minnesotans can be proud that this big tent is shared by like-minded lawmakers that have begun the hard work to address global warming, lessen Minnesota's dependence on imported energy, provide a foundation to innovation, research, and entrepreneurship, and help to put Minnesota back in the driver's seat as a renewable energy leader at every level. After you pass this bill, I'll be looking forward to further legislation about community energy ownership, biofuels, conservation and efficiency, and global warming. Thanks for doing the job you do, and thanks for allowing me here today.
Thank you, Mr. Nenneman. Any questions for this witness? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You kind of acknowledged it in the end, but if we then pass another piece of legislation relating to energy and ownership structure, what do you think is going to happen with ownership opportunities if this bill passes and nothing else does?
Mr. Nenneman.
I think that the CDUD bill that was passed 2 years ago was certainly the beginning of a good foundation for community ownership in Minnesota. But I am confident that the work that's being done in the community, seabed community, and the assurances that I've had from other legislators this year brings me to believe that it's not necessary, for instance, to do a carve-out in this bill, but to rather let larger work be done in a seabed bill on its own.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I realize that if that premise becomes a reality, but if this bill is all that passes, what do you think it does for ownership opportunities if nothing else passes this legislature?
Mr. Nenneman?
I think it makes it more difficult to provide the incentives for community ownership. However, I think that largely the economics of play will still allow for a significant of seabed projects to come through based on the previous legislation.
Thank you.
Members, if there are no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Nimmer.
Thank you.
Sounds like you have a pretty good deal here, Representative Peterson.
Thanks, Mr. If I may.
Representative Peterson.
In last week's committee, Representative Poppy asked me a question about Subdivision 5, technology based on fuel combustion. I answered that incorrectly. And Mr. Eliff sent out an email to the committee members as to why my answer was wrong. And for the record, for the audience who didn't get that email, maybe Mr. Eliff could go through as it relates to potential inclusion of whatever it's called lately, Mesaba, Excelsior Energy up on the range.
Thank you. Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we're talking about is in Subdivision 5 of the bill, current statutory language, which states conditions under which electricity produced by fuel combustion can count towards the utility's objectives or, if this bill is passed, the renewable energy standard. And there are two of them. The plant was constructed in compliance with new source performance standards promulgated under the Federal Clean Air Act for a generation facility of that type, or employs the maximum achievable or best available control technology available for a generation facility of that type. That language refers to federal requirements to meet federal air pollution control standards, so I called to the PCA and spoke with people there who are working on the air quality permit for the Mesaba plant, and they indicated that in order to be built, the plant has to meet all of those standards anyway. So if the plant is built, it would seem that they would also meet this requirement to be counted towards the REO or the RES.
Back to Mr. Eloff. Does anyone have a question about that? That's pretty straightforward. Next on the agenda, Mr. Peterson and Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chairman and committee, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Peterson. I serve as president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and Farmers Union is a grass-based general farm organization that has advocated on behalf of farmers and rural residents since about 1929. On behalf of the membership of the Minnesota Farmers Union, I'm here to urge you your support today of House File 4 authored by Representative Aaron Peterson that would establish a renewable energy standard in Minnesota, attaining 25% of Minnesota's energy from wind power and other sources such as biomass by the year 2020. Minnesota Farmers Union is proud to have been a strong supporter of this legislation of renewable fuels and energy for quite some time. With the standard, MFU, Minnesota Farmers Union, sees the same potential with wind energy and biomass that we have seen in the development of ethanol and biodiesel and having a positive impact on rural economies and the environment. And in discussing the idea of standard, as the author of the ethanol legislation, while I served in the House, that this standard would certainly have a certain kind of impact, same impact as the ethanol mandate has had on Minnesota economies. And, Mr. Chairman, I want to digress a little bit from my prepared comments. They talk about 12,000 jobs. I did a little quick math on that, and that's $480 million of income. When we were at the prefaces or at the ethanol mandate, and I believe there was a lot of bipartisan support on that, we were actually talking about having jobs in rural Minnesota, but I don't think the potential was ever realized when we were talking about the debate. So to Representative Westrom's question or to the jobs, we invested about $450 million in ethanol in the state of Minnesota and still investing. We have about a $1.5 billion return. And I see this wind as a parallel to that same kind of investment. And the investment will be, yes, it will be metro investment, but there will be more investment in rural Minnesota, and there will be less carbon in this country because of this investment and standard. And what I would like to say to you as a committee, if we do not do this now, when are we going to do it? When will this become law so that we can have an economy in rural Minnesota? And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I have with me Gary Wilson, who is a farmer from southwestern Minnesota, from Jackson, who is directly involved in wind energy as part of a, I believe it's a co-op that you're involved with. The economic potential of 3,000 wind generators and the footprint, and you have to start thinking about the steel, the concrete, and the turbines and those jobs. Frankly, we're very excited in rural Minnesota about that potential. We will never see an opportunity like this ever again. I compare this to when John Deere invented the steel plow. We have been farming like the steel plow forever. Times are changing, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. This is a new era for farming. Yes, we own the land, we're the resource owners, and we want the chance to be able to have that investment. And I think rural residents also believe very strongly in the fact that their rural cousins have the opportunity to have jobs and that infrastructure fulfilled so that those schools can be filled, those churches can be filled, and there'll be businesses on Main Street. That's the intent of my testimony today. So with that, I want to consider, or have you urge your consideration of House File 4, pass this language, and move on to a more producing a more clean and efficient energy that will bring development to rural Minnesota. And with that, I want to introduce Gary Wilson. He's the Farmers Union President, the County President from Jackson, from Odin, Minnesota, and he has some prepared comments for you. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Come over here. There
my name is Gary Wilson. I'm a farmer of approximately 640 acres in Wattama, Jackson County. I raise corn and soybeans. I am a current Jackson County president of the Farmers Union. I'm also the director of the Tri-Mont Area Wind Farm located in Martin and Jackson County. I live about 2.5 miles from a gas and diesel-fired electrical peaking plant, and the transmission line that made this idea of a wind farm so unique. We needed, as the farmers and owners of the land got together in the year, the fall of 2002, we formed an LLC. After we formed the LLC, we decided we needed to raise some money in order to hire a business consultant. We needed the business consultant to tell us what direction to go, what lawyers we needed to hire, what permitting we had to have done. And so we needed to raise approximately $600,000. And this was over about 8,000 acres of land, 40-some landowners. And so we needed someone to buy our power. And our RFP was a request for power, and that was any company that was on the transition line that went past the peaking plant. We put a bid in as the RFP was, which is a request for power that we received from Great River Energy. And Great River, we kept on negotiating with them with a price of what we were selling power to them for. We did the permitting, and once we were picked as the top five, we then had to decide whether we were going to own the wind turbines, which we needed to get financing for, or sell, so to speak, sell the project. In my thinking, we didn't really sell the project, but a lot of people think that we did. But we do receive some revenues from what the company that we chose to, which was PPM, which is Pacific Power Mutual Management, based out of Portland, Oregon. Some of the permitting that we had to have done was to do with groundwater, wetlands, and big issues was setbacks for the land. This is the distance from other landowners, and I think this is a big, big issue that we need to cover, and we need to have the setback so that it doesn't interfere with the wind of our neighboring landowners. Our power agreement was settled. Everything has been up and running for over a year now. It was totally commissioned in November of 2005, and we've been under a full year's operation now. Unfortunately, we've had a bad year of 2006 was a bad year of wind in July, August, and September. The way I understand it, we don't know for sure yet, but we don't know if we're going to receive any revenues, but I think that we're going to have bumpy roads like that, and not every year is alike. So with that, I urge that you pass this bill with 25/2020.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Are there questions for either Mr. Peterson or Mr. Wilson, Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wilson, if the ownership model would have been different and the LLC would have owned the windmills, would it have been even more harmful than having it the way that the Tri-Mont Wind Farm is? More detrimental to the...
In what way?
Well, you say it was a bad year for wind, and you aren't having, probably going to get your production credit, production money that you would have gotten. If you would have owned the windmills, would it have been more harmful to you financially than the way it is now?
Mr. Wilson?
I would say it would have, in the situation that it is, it didn't bother us at all, because we don't have that much invested. I think the people that invested in it are still making money, even at the rate that at the yield that they're receiving. I don't feel that it hurt us, but if we would have owned it, no, I don't think it would have hurt us then either.
Okay.
But unfortunately, well, I should say fortunately, the people that we would have gone with to borrow the money to build the wind turbine, from my understanding, the company was about bankrupt.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, members? Mr. Peterson, Mr. Wilson, thank you.
Okay.
Next on the agenda, we have Mike Franklin. I believe Ms. Hodnick from Minnesota Power has been delayed. We'll try to work on that later point in the hearing. So, Mr. Franklin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Energy Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Our member company's electric energy policy is to maintain and invest in a reliable, competitively priced energy system in Minnesota. Right now, that's the main competitive advantage for doing business in our state. We're clearly entering a costly period for energy, and there are many reasons for the recent expenses being paid for by ratepayers. The commodity and transportation costs of fuel have skyrocketed. Several utilities have begun to raise their retail and wholesale electric rates, and the transmission to the new day two market, which you heard about, has been anything but smooth for customers who have borne the risk of this fundamental change in how utilities trade wholesale power. Some other reasons do have to do with some policy decisions. The Metro Emissions Reduction Proposal, or MERP, was a result of the 2001 legislative session. MERP added an average of about 5% per year to the Xcel Energy customer's bill. You know, 5% may not sound much when you think of your electric bill at home, and maybe not even for a small retail company, but for a mid-sized St. Cloud manufacturer, MERP meant about an additional $25,000 a year in electric costs. And for a St. Paul, a large industrial customer, that price was closer to $400,000. There are some more expenses, as we've said, sort of loaded in the gun. For instance, last year's legislature unanimously approved the nation's most aggressive mercury reduction law. And we supported that legislation not only because we recognize its importance, but also because the bill, as it was crafted, allowed gave the Public Utilities Commission maximum flexibility to protect customers. And the first filings are in from the utilities affected by that law, Minnesota Power and Xcel Energy. Minnesota Power's improvements will require over $200 million from customers in northeast Minnesota, and the tab for Xcel's improvement is in, this is improvements for mercury and other reasons, at over $900 million. And that's a similar cost to MERP. You heard a little bit a couple of weeks back about the cost of managing the system, in other words, the study that was done by the Public Utilities Commission. And we do hope that utilities follow up with a rate analysis off of Mr. Wolf's work. Some have concluded that the report's estimated cost of the wind integration is chump change, but our analysis is somewhat different. Before a windmill is ever purchased or a transmission line is ever built, the same data that Mr. Wolf shared with us that showed an impact for an average Dakota electric residential customer to be $14 per year, our same St. Cloud manufacturer would be on the hook for, given the various, the range that he presented us, anywhere from $8,000 to $31,000 per year. And our large industrial company in St. Paul could see an additional $135,000 to $270,000. And those increases are obviously not in a vacuum. These things are adding up, and our fear is that we're sort of on the verge of experiencing a perfect storm that could keep our companies from expanding in Minnesota and ultimately have a negative impact on our negative net impact on our economy. That said, we recommend an aggressive but a careful approach to changing our renewable energy policy. As drafted, the bill before you, House File 4, we don't believe it adequately protects customers because, in our opinion, the Public Utilities Commission is not told as directly as possible to consider the competitive and economic pressures faced by utilities' customers when deciding whether or if to modify or delay the new mandate. The companion legislation that passed the Senate committee last week contains some of this language, and we think that it represents a sort of adequate balance to bring to the Public Utilities Commission, balancing our need to invest in more renewable energy with economic realities found in, especially in rate-sensitive industries in Minnesota. Ultimately, our belief is that the very best approach would be to increase the renewable energy objective to 25% by 2025, as proposed by the governor in the Next Generation Energy Initiative. The good faith effort provision of that policy provides the most flexibility for customers. And I think if you've heard from nearly everyone testifying about the REO, it's also an extremely aggressive objective that has gotten results. We look forward to being part of your discussion as the committee works to set a policy that builds on the successful strategy of aggressively supporting renewable energy policies in Minnesota that achieve results while protecting ratepayers. Thank you, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
I think Representative Wagenius has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Franklin. As I listened to your argument about the expense of electricity and as you go through it, you seem to be making a very powerful argument for conservation. Does the chamber have a specific conservation plan that it has put on the table?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the answer is no, not yet, but the longer answer is we're actually working on that a program per recommendation of our board of directors based on some research we've done last summer. We, too, recognize the value, the economic value of conservation and efficiency and have a plan in store, but nothing just yet.
Representative Wagenius.
Quick follow-up. Do you know when those plans will be available?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, this year, I think our president, David Olson, has made it a priority to get something to promote our policy aggressively this year. We actually had a meeting on Friday that we got the definite signal from Mr. Olson to step on the gas. No pun intended.
Does sound kind of counterproductive, Mr. Green. There, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman. Hilton, to our testifier, you had stated that you're in favor of what came out of the Senate. What is your official position on the bill that passed out of the Senate committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, actually, we're sort of neutral on the bill that passed the Senate. As I mentioned, our preferred approach, which we think would most adequately blend the needs of customers with the needs of the state's economy, would be to increase the REO to 25 by 25. We do, however, congratulate the Senate for reaching for inserting some language that we think gives the PUC pretty direct orders to consider the economic impact of implementing the mandate.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Franklin would do well or better off if he would respect the bill that's in front of this committee and this body before he keeps rattling on about what the Senate may or may not have accomplished.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the witness was responding to a direct question from Mr. Welty, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I understand the sensitivity of discussing this bill, but I think the witness responded to a direct question from one of our colleagues. And
I think that's correct, Representative Beard. Thank you for pointing that out. Appears there are no further questions, Mr. Franklin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Mr. Ambrose. Mr. Ambrose, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Bob Ambrose, Manager of Governmental Affairs for Great River Energy. I testified quite recently, but let me run through a few of the items that I mentioned at that time. Great River Energy is headquartered in Elk River. We provide wholesale electric service to 28 distribution co-ops in Minnesota. Together, they serve more than 60% of the land mass of Minnesota. Great River Energy has been providing electricity from wind power since 1998, when we started one of the first voluntary green energy subscription programs in the United States at Chandler in southwestern Minnesota. In 2005, we added 100 megawatts of wind at Trimont. I didn't realize that Mr. Wilson was going to be here this afternoon, but that project resulted from an RFP that Great River Energy issued where we indicated that we would give preference to a project that was owned by local people and preferably located within the service territory of one of our member co-ops. The group in Tremont won that competition. Mr. Wilson went through some of the process that the group underwent to make it a success. The result was the first commercial scale landowner developed wind project in the United States. We're very proud of that and share Mr. Wilson's pride. That project brought our percentage of renewables to about 5%. We're currently developing another 100 megawatt project in Maurer County that should bring our percentage of renewables to about 8% by the end of this year. We're also in final negotiations on a 120 megawatt seabed wind project in southern Minnesota that should put us over 10% in renewables when that goes online. I believe it will be constructed in 2008, so the end of 2008 or early 2009 we should be over 10%. When I testified before, I said that we could accept a renewable energy mandate if the package was right. And at risk of mentioning the other body too specifically, we have been active participants in a process over there, and we do support the results of that process. Key part of that project, or that process, which we supported when I was here before and we continue to support, is 20% wind or 20% renewable requirement in 2020. We've also supported going to 25% in 2025. Of course, we sought adequate safeguards that would allow some adjustment in the schedule if there are problems that arise that are not due to the fault of the utility. And we were strong advocates of a green, a renewable energy credit trading system, so that if one utility was ahead of the pace and another was behind, that there could be some trading of credits among them to make it work. As I mentioned, we do support that package. We would like to work with you, Mr. Chairman, and with you, Mr. Peterson, Representative Peterson, especially if we can end up in a similar spot. So we're very open to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Representative Wagenius?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Ambrose. When you were here before, we chatted about the fact that you are proposing a very large coal facility just across the border in South Dakota. And that has become very controversial because of all the folks who are worried about carbon and understand that we have to take a different tactic now, that things that were good 2 years ago, everybody understands, aren't right now. What standard would be sufficient for you or for your company to say that we now know that we need to no longer proceed with the Big Stone project?
Mr. Ambrose?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius. Well, as you know, we're one of seven partners in that project, so I couldn't speak for all of them. I would simply say that our support for renewable energy is not to say that renewable energy, particularly wind, at least as we know of and as we anticipate its role in the overall system, cannot entirely replace a baseload system. We do want to make sure that any baseload that we're involved in has the least possible impact on the environment. We're actively seeking solutions for capturing carbon in some of our other facilities. We would seek your support in finding those solutions, frankly. Part of the problem, I think, is capturing the carbon in a way that still makes economic sense while also protecting the environment.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Ambrose, I didn't expect you to answer for six other folks. I just wanted to know the river's position, and I truly would still like to hear it. But when you talk about looking for other alternatives, since Big Stone was promoted as an alternative, as one thing to do, we have heard about new baseload possibilities that are actually carbon negative. And that's a new vocabulary for us. And given where we have to go between now and the next 25 and 50 years, it seems that we've got to move away from things that are heavily carbon and look at things that are actually carbon negative. Has your company actually sat down and talked about using the carbon negative grasses that the new science?
I'm glad you specified. The target carbon negative reference that I heard beginning of last week related, if I'm correct, to an ethanol plant that used cellulosic carbon. Is that right?
If I could.
Representative McGee.
Dr. Tillman testified before this joint committees in the House. He talked about using native species, multiple species, over 16, and when you do that, it's hard for me to do the science, but what he was essentially saying is they take so much carbon out of the air that when you burn them, you're not doing much.
Right.
But
right.
The super benefit is they're sinking carbon in their roots, which are very deep and very extensive. And so we've come to one of those points where we have to rethink what we're doing because we know we can no longer go the old path. And so that's why I came back to my question of what is a sufficient renewable energy standard for you to say we're going to rethink what we're doing, and when we rethink what we're doing, we're going to think about a base load that is carbon negative.
Mr. Hammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I would say that a fair assessment of our co-op at this time is that we're rethinking everything, including what you have specified. There are still present needs, and that's what. What the Big Stone project represents, but for example, at our largest existing power plant in North Dakota, which is a coal plant, we have just brought online an ethanol plant that uses the waste heat from that plant to produce the energy required to get the ethanol. Now, that's still a corn-based ethanol plant, but we're certainly not averse to looking at the cellulosic ethanol plants or any other possibilities that might reduce our carbon impact.
Representative Bryant.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Ambrose, two-part question, and I'm going to try to make it so that you can summarize it fairly clearly or simply, and I know that it might not be that easy, but you indicated what standard you'd like to see without summarizing your key objections to your key issues for why 25 by 20 is problematic. And I mean, you indicated the standard you'd like, so I'd like you to give me maybe 3 bullet points that summarize that, and then I'd like you to answer, given all the testimony we've heard about the kind of confluence of energy and circumstances around this issue, why a more aggressive approach might not produce a more productive result when we have 13 years lead-up time to look at and evaluate that. So why not take the risk? So two parts. What are your objections, and then why not?
Okay.
Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Let me deal with the risk first, if I could. We feel that 20 by 20 and 25 by 20, which are essentially on the same trajectory, are risks in themselves. They are risks in our assessment that we think we can overcome. We think that there are goals that are at the same time a large stretch, but something that's achievable. The aspects of the legislation that give comfort to many utilities include the what's been called off-ramps, the consideration of rates, reliability, technological problems, and the transmission issues. Those are all very real issues. Our goal is to construct and support a system that is both a stretch, but that we also are reasonably confident is achievable without having to go in and adjust the schedule. We'd like to be successful in achieving something. That it may turn out, 5 or 10 years down the way, that we were too conservative, or it may turn out that we were too aggressive. I don't know. But I think that the 20 by 20 or 25 by 25 is a stretch, but something that's achievable, and that's been our goal. I'm not sure if I covered all of your questions.
Representative Brenner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ambrose, you answered the first part reasonably well, but not the second part. If the goal is worth achieving, is the more aggressive standard an impetus in itself toward the kind of restructuring that would allow us to achieve the goal? And we've had a lot of testimony in that direction, and that indicates that, yes, that would happen, and I want to understand why you would say no to that.
Mr. Ambrose?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what I would say to that is that there are many parts of this. And part of it is the renewable energy piece. Another part that we feel very strongly about is the conservation and energy efficiency piece. We have some ideas I may have alluded to earlier about tightening building codes. I think I did mention incentives for LEED buildings, LEED certified buildings. I'd like to have a notification when you purchase a home of what the estimated energy usage is. The kind of the common theme in our issues and our suggestions are that there's a lot that the utilities can do, but this is a problem that's bigger than just the utilities. It requires action from each of us individually and in other sectors, including the transportation sector especially.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you very much.
Members, we obviously are running short on time. I think Ms. Hodnick from Minnesota Power has arrived, and we can get through that testimony, at least we may have to carry a couple people over into Wednesday's meeting. And let me take this opportunity also to say we will try certainly to get to amendments on Wednesday, make sure that any that you wish to propose are in the hands of Mr. Pomeroy 24 hours in advance. We'd really appreciate that, and we will share those with members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hilton.
Representative Westrom.
Just, Mr. Chairman, if there's... Is the list of today the only testifiers we have that you know of, or if people are interested, they should get a hold of your office if they want to make more comments, or anybody new?
Representative Westrom, the list that we have is the only one that I know of, but certainly if anyone does wish to offer testimony, we'll try to give them an opportunity to do that, and they should contact Mr. Pomeroy.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Hilty, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Hodnick, and I'm the Director of Regulatory and Public Affairs for Minnesota Power. And I was before you a few weeks ago to describe Minnesota Power and our system, our current renewables, and our renewable additions, so I won't go into any details about that again. I will mention again, though, however, how vital our large industries are to Minnesota Power. Someone was talking about power bills earlier, and I want to mention that U.S. Steel, who has two facilities on our system, has an electric bill that is about $90 million every month, and it's those kind of power bills, as well as those of the rest of our customers, that we are concerned about and aware of whenever we talk about costs, because those large industrial customers, as I mentioned, employ thousands in our region, and they indirectly employ thousands of others, so they're very important to the regional economy. And as we're talking about economic development and wanting to grow economic development in Minnesota, we also, I think, want to maintain the economic success that we have, and particularly with these competitive large industries that are so vital to northeastern Minnesota. As far as House File 4 is concerned, it wants to add renewables and increase renewables, and we endorse increasing renewables. We are doing that. We are adding them. We will continue to add them. But as we do that, we will balance three things, and I've mentioned these three things before. And one of them is cost. Another is reliability, and the other one is environmental impact. And we believe that in any energy decision that we have to make, or anyone has to make, adding energy anywhere in Minnesota, it's important to think about all three of those things. We can't just think about one or two and ignore the third, because customers expect all three of those things that any energy supply that they get from Minnesota Power or any other supplier in Minnesota. We're very concerned about meeting a 25% standard in 2025 and delivering on all three of those things that I just told you. And again, our customers expect all three of those things from us. 25% in 2020 actually is even more daunting for us and concerning for us, particularly because of our system, which I know I described to you before when I was here, that it's a high demand system. It doesn't have fluctuations that a lot of other utility systems have, which means that we need baseload power in strong quantities 24 hours a day. And wind energy, for all of its positive attributes, is not a baseload resource. It fluctuates, and then you've got to fill it in with other forms of energy. And there's nothing wrong with that to a certain degree on our system, but if anyone thinks that we're going to be able to serve our load with large quantities of wind energy, that just won't work. That will not be the case for us. We are adding wind. We have added some. We plan to add more. We will add as much as we think is technically and financially feasible, but people need to realize that when we look at a renewable standard, we're looking at things that are baseload resources like biomass and others that we're seeking out that can provide that 24-hour-a-day energy supply without fluctuation. We believe that Minnesota can add renewables and increase renewable supply, and there's no reason why we can't have adequate due diligence on cost and reliability while we're doing that. While we're having due diligence on adding renewable supply, we can do the same thing with cost and reliability. All three should occur at the same time. And in summary, just one other comment I would make about the language of any final bill is that we should be as explicit about the provision of reliability and reasonable cost as we are about the numeric additions that we would make for renewables, again, to keep all of that in balance. Those are my comments.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Beer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hodnick, Minnesota Power's got a pretty marvelous and ingenious system of hydroelectric generating facilities, don't you?
Yes.
Do those run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Representative Beard, they do run whenever we have water. They don't necessarily run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because we don't have that volume of water. But whenever we have the water, we run them.
All right.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hodnick, I understand you're to meet the 25% renewable level that you're likely going to have to purchase significant amounts of energy. How does could you just go through that with me? How does that go? How do you do that? Just buy it from another? Could you go through what your company steps you go through to do that?
Ms. Hodnick?
Chair Hilke, Representative Magnus. Well, we develop a resource plan, as every utility is required to, that is required to under the statutes. Every 2 years, we develop a plan that forecasts what our load growth is going to be for the next 15 years. And then we look at resource options based on cost, reliability, and environmental impact, and come up with a package of what we would propose to add and go before the Public Utilities Commission to get their approval after the input of many people through testimony and comment on what that general resource plan should be. Then once we get that general blessing, we go out and seek resources through competitive bidding processes and also looking at what we might be able to build or augment on our own system. And again, we look at the cost, we look at the reliability and the environmental impact of that before we propose individual additions to the Public Utilities Commission, and they go through a due diligence process on each individual addition that we make, again, looking at all those different factors before they sign off on it. Did that answer your question?
Yeah,
sir?
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Knuth.
I was wondering, I didn't hear in your testimony if you support a renewable energy standard, the 20 by 2020, is that, does your company view that as problematic for your energy planning and growth?
Ms. Hodnick.
Chair Hilke, Representative, 20% by 2020 or 25% by 2025 would be standards that we think we could meet. They would be challenges for us to meet in any case, but we would work to meet those challenges. With any standard, whatever the number is, as long as there was, again, explicit recognition of cost and reliability along with that renewable energy decision, as long as all those three things were considered, you know, I think we could find legislation workable regardless of the number, although 20% by 2020 or 25% by 2025 would be more reasonable from the standpoint of where our system is at and where our customers are at.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving from that, the question of 20% by 2020, I think, has become more reasonable all of a sudden to a lot of companies, and I'm wondering what kind of work has been done in the last couple of years, particularly for Minnesota Power, because, as you said, you're different than a lot of other utilities in that you have a high demand with no real peaks and dips, like a lot of the other utility companies, and I would be particularly interested to hear what kind of work has been done to look at how your company will be able to meet renewable energy standards and has come to the position where they would be challenges but doable.
Ms. Hodnick.
Chair Hilke, Representative. Part of what would make it doable for us, which is also reflected in this bill, House File 4, is that we could include the Thompson Hydro system that Representative Beard was talking about. That would help us. We also have been doing quite a bit of work on biomass, and we believe there are biomass opportunities that are going to be in reach with us for us that will be that 24-hour-a-day type of energy.
We also have been looking at, we made some wind additions, and we've got some purchasing opportunities, a combination with wind additions that we think can supplement the upper part of our system where we've got more fluctuation. So, plus, I just think there's just more availability of wind than there was before, and there's opportunities for more transmission to be built, like the CapEx group is proposing in Minnesota, so that will make wind more available, again, for that top part of our system where we could handle that. So in a number of ways, we see it being possible to increase our renewable supply. But again, we want to do it in a balanced way with taking all the factors into account before we make a decision.
Further questions? Ms. Heinrich, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Oxley, do you want to squeeze in what you want to tell us in the next 5 minutes, or would you prefer to come back on Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as is often the case, being last, I shall be brief. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. There are 853 cities in the state, and the municipal utilities serve 126 of them. We have about 14% of the electric load in the state. It occurred to us when we were looking at this legislation for the past 3 years, as we pondered it, that we can either be real happy or real sad about what we've done in the next, when we look back in 10 years. We can either be very proud of what we've started here, because this is the first step. I mean, this is not going to be the last piece of renewable legislation you see. I would guess, and I think that we would all see that this is going to be a continuing process. But we want that first step to be a safe step-by-step progression into the widespread use of renewables. We want to have something that we can deliver. That is what our thinking has been. Last August, we started to work on a bill of our own, and we're not considering that bill, I understand. But we started looking at this, at what we thought we could do, and what we thought was reasonable, given all the considerations. Our position on HF4 is not that we oppose the general concepts of this legislation. We think the 25% by 2020 is simply a bridge too far. And with regard to the question by Representative Knuth, we believe that that's the case largely because of the issue of transmission. That is the 800-pound gorilla in this particular room. We are going to need 6 to 7 very big transmission lines, we've been told recently, that are going to come from the west to the east to get the power from where it's made to where it's needed. And we don't believe that we can do that in that amount by the year 2020. We just don't think we can. We also are very concerned about balancing the system, and MISO is concerned about that as well, and the MISO process has to be taken into consideration. It takes a long time to build the transmission that you need, not only when you deal with the state of Minnesota, but when you deal with the Midwest Independent System Operators, which is the RTO for this area, Regional Transmission Organization, forgive me. We also think that while we like the present off-ramps, rate increases, reliability issues, technical concerns, we think that there's got to be more. There has to be something talking about transmission, the equipment delivery, and permit approval. We also would like to have some assurance that we're going to have a renewable energy credit trading system. We think we need that as well. And we'd like to be able to phase out our green pricing program, because a lot of us have built wind transmission to provide this kind of green pricing. That's a program that requires you to provide green power to customers if they ask for it. We can't use that towards our renewable energy standard. We'd like to be able to phase out this program so that we can use those things. This is not opposition. This is merely refinements of what Representative Peterson has offered, and we hope that they will be accepted. And that's all I have to say, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ackley. Questions? Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say we were told that we would need 6 to 7 large power lines from the west to the east to get this power in, who told you that?
This was at a symposium on December 4th.
Actually.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, we were told that in a symposium, and it was a transmission utility engineer from Xcel who said this, and he was speculating what the needs were going to be, that that is what we're going to need. Well, right now, that's all we can give you is sheer speculation. We can, if we cannot deliver this power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to our customers, and if anything causes that to be a problem, I can guarantee you that we have failed in our job, and we don't want to fail in our job.
Representative Reiner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Oxley, I'd like you to follow up on Representative Knuth's question. I don't know if you were present for the testimony by the, some of the community-based project people, but I'm wondering how you assess the transmission issue in relation to the testimony we heard about community-based potential and whether that modifies that issue at all, because for many of us, that's critical in our assessment of that transmission challenge.
I can't even begin to pretend that I understand anything about the arcane Byzantine world of the transmission utility engineer. I am a political science major. And when I went to pilot training, only I and the Iranians flunked the aerodynamics test. I only represent what they've told me. And we haven't had time to do the kinds of studies that we need to do to make this happen. We only know this, and this is it. This is just words for the committee based on my experience in watching things go wrong. In California, we were told for several years that California was the end-all and be-all when it came to retail wheeling. They had the best legislation there was. It was, we were all a bunch of rubes for not following them. I was told that at national meeting after national meeting. But because California took all of their hopes and dreams, instead of their know-how and instead of their care, and threw it into a bill, they ended up with the biggest self-induced catastrophe in the history of the electric utility industry. I'm not saying that HF4 will do that, but we would like to take a very step-by-step approach on this whole thing, and this would be a good first step, we believe. I haven't directly answered your question, and I am sorry, but I can't.
Representative Welty, last words.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. And to Representative Peterson or to Mr. Oxley, could you just please inform me of why green pricing cannot be included in the current language to count towards your renewable energy standard?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Oxley.
The whole idea of the green pricing program was to get utilities involved with the widespread use of renewables. We believe it's redundant now. Now that we have a mandate at least as high as 20% by 2020, and perhaps even higher, it's just not necessary anymore because everybody's going to be getting a slice of renewables. Also, to our surprise, the Public Utilities Commission ruled in, I think it was 2004, it might have been 2003, that even though it wasn't specifically in the bill, we couldn't use stuff that we'd built for green pricing in any sort to meet a renewable energy objective, and that appears to us to be counterproductive. Well, let's throw the stuff in that we built and make this thing happen.
Thank you, Mr. Oxley. Members, obviously we've run over our time. We had Xcel Energy on the agenda for today. I apologize, Ms. Engelking. We will give you the opportunity to come back on Wednesday and take as much time as you need at the beginning of Wednesday, and then we will move on either to other testifiers that come forward or to taking up amendments. Meeting is adjourned.